is the map of solar gravity. And then you ask the person, which one is bigger? And the guy usually will say, well, gee, the moon is smaller, but it's so close, and the moon creates the tide, therefore the lunar gravity must be the bigger one. Not true. The solar gravity is the bigger one. It's about 150 times bigger. To which you say, what in the world's going on here? Well, from one point of view, the Earth is pretty smart. It's going to go around the thing that is giving it the greatest amount of gravity. Does the Earth go around the moon as in its orbit? Not really. The Earth goes around the sun. That's the dominant gravity as far as the Earth is concerned. It goes around the sun, but it gets this wobble from the moon during the time it's doing it. Okay, if the solar gravity is 100 times bigger than the lunar gravity, how the heck does the moon create the tide compared to the sun? The sun creates very little tide by comparison. How in the world can the smaller gravity, 150 times smaller, create the tide? Another set of questions you can ask somebody as a puzzle. Good job. And the answer is the near field effect. The moon is only a quarter of a million miles away. The sun is 93 million miles away. That ratio is, let me think, 93 versus a quarter. It's almost a 350-to-1 ratio. The moon is 350 times closer than the sun. It therefore has a lot of near field effect. The portion of the Earth and water that's near the moon on that side is 8,000 miles closer than the water and Earth that's on the far side, because the Earth has a radius, a diameter of 8,000 miles. 8,000 miles of difference, because gravity is a function of inverse square law. Every time you double the distance between you and some massive object, the amount of gravity you feel changes by 4 to 1. Every time you double. So that 8,000 miles of difference of diameter of the Earth and this much, much closer moon means that the total amount of gravity sensed by the water on the lunar side is considerably greater than the amount of gravity from the moon sensed on the far side of the Earth. That's why you get tides on the near side. And because the water and Earth on the far side of the Earth away from the moon senses less gravity, that's one reason why you get another bulge on the far side, and you're also getting the bulge because of the wobble of the Earth. It's just the way the system balances. It's amazing that the amount of tide on the near side and the amount of tide on the far side, you're getting a bulge of tide on both sides. They're almost identical to each other. Okay. However, as weak as the solar gravity is by comparison when it comes to this near field effect, still, when you get a full moon, that really means that the Earth, Sun, and Moon are in one.
Repeater, timeout.
At the time of a full moon, Sun, Earth, and Moon, in that order, are in one straight line. Therefore, the amount of tide created by the moon and the amount of tide created by the sun are in line with each other, and it tends to raise the tide, particularly on the side toward the sun. The same thing happens during new moon. During new moon, when the moon is on the solar side, you now have a lineup of sun, moon, and earth in that order. You also get a nice high tide during that particular time. When the moon is at first quarter or last quarter, which means now the moon is at right angles, you draw a line between sun and earth, and then you have to make a right angle bend in order to draw a line from Earth up to Moon. When the Moon is at first quarter or third quarter, at that time, first quarter or last quarter, I'm going to call it, at that time, the gravity of the Moon and the gravity of the Sun are at right angles together, and you get the least amount of tide. So you get a little more tide when they line up, you get a lot less tide when they don't line up. That gives you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on here. The dynamics of the system, believe it or not, it's a bit more complicated than this, but at least it gives you a little bit of a feel for what's going on. You'd be amazed how many people don't know that there are two tides at each instant of time, two high tides across the Earth, near side of the moon and far side of the moon. And because of the near field effect and the wobble effect, That's how they're happening. Now you know a little bit why you get two tides per day. Roughly once every 12 hours you get a high tide, because as the Earth rotates, you're getting one on the near side and one on the far side. Maybe that helps, John. KC2WGB, K2YIW, the tech man. A minor in astronomy. I'm not an expert in this area. You got it, John.
Very good, Dick. I'm sure he'll appreciate that. I thought that was a good question from the 12-year-old. The phase of the moon should have nothing to do with it because the moon is still there. That's good logic. I like that. And also, if he reads about the tides of the moon on the internet, you will find that there are areas on the Earth where there are no tide changes. And then there are areas like in Nova Scotia where the tide change is drastic. That's the largest in the world, largest tidal difference. So the tides are not the same all over the world. I never knew that until a few years ago. I thought basically you had high tides and low tides all over. The equator is almost the minimum point. So very good. And I do have a little talk about a test I made with magnets and the unipolar magnet after Paul. And I'd like to discuss that after that, if you got time. KC2WGB, back to you.
And by the way, in previous weeks, John and I were discussing this hybrid-like device that he purchased at a ridiculous price. He bought a pair of them for $19. I think they were $500 a piece. Beautiful made thing by Hewlett Packard. If you go to QIZ.com and dial in KC2WGB, you'll see a beautiful picture of this thing that John took. Very nice piece of electronics. By the way, from my point of view, astronomy is about the most pure science there is. I say pure because, with rare exceptions, you can't make a lot of money with it. And yet, that as a science, the astronomy and astrophysics and whatever, has some extremely deep questions that mankind should be more than curious about. Where did this universe come from? How did our galaxy form? How did our galactic group form? How did our solar system form? How did the Earth form? How in the world did the moon form around the Earth? How come we're so lucky to be in the Goldilocks zone where we've got just the right temperature so that water is mostly in the liquid form, and we've got this beautiful water-borne planet with oxygen and air and all these other good things, and life is on this planet? Is there other life in the universe? The answer has got to be yes. How many of those stars out there have got planets? How many of those are in the Goldilocks zone? How many of them have hydrocarbon life as we know it? When will we have the great big Cusco in the sky? You can see there's some huge, mind-bending questions that can be asked and partially answered by astronomy. And as you build better and better astronomy instruments, like a ultra-large telescope at the European Southern Observatory, or like the Hubble Space Telescope, or like the James Webb Telescope that's under construction and going to be put into space. When you build better and better pieces of hardware, the Keck Telescope, which is in space and it has already measured about 400 exoplanets it has found, and already has about 1,500 other candidates that are eventually going to be confirmed as stars that have planets going around them. Build the right kind of hardware that can make astronomical measurements, and you start answering some of these questions, which give you brand new questions. My goodness, how do we fit into this great big universe? How long is it going to last for us? Are we alone? How many others are out there? How many have visited us? Are those UFOs really foreign, or are they domestic, or are they just a misinterpretation? These are all astronomical questions from my point of view. It's an extremely deep, mind-boggling, curiosity-fulfilling set of questions, and yet you can't make a whole lot of money with it, with rare exception. That makes it a very pure science by my point of view. But as you study astronomical objects, and you learn more and more about the universe, and by radio astronomy you find out how many organic molecules are out there floating around in space, waiting to land on some particular planet to start the life process. There's a whole lot of organic molecules that have been measured floating around in space with radio telescopes. So again, it's a matter of the right kind of instrumentation, the right kind of hardware, to make the right kind of measurements. They ask some really interesting questions from my point of view. So astronomy is a beautiful thing to study. One of the very nice astronomy books, which is one of my favorites, an oldie but goodie.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
An extremely nice optical astronomy book with a little bit of radio astronomy mixed into it is Baker, B-A-K-E-R. That's the author. And I think it's called Introduction to Astronomy. I believe the book is in its 9th edition. I think I've got a copy of the 7th edition. By way of going to Amazon or eBay or whatever to get a used copy of Baker, it is a beautiful mixture of a little bit of mathematics, a reasonable number of pictures, a reasonable explanation, fairly nice diagrams and whatever. You can sort of understand it. There are astronomy books that are real heavy into mathematics and they'll snow you. There are astronomy books that are real heavy into a bunch of pretty pictures, but they don't tell you anything. They show you a whole bunch of pretty pictures. Baker, from my point of view, is a very nice mixture of a little bit of math, some pretty nice diagrams, not the most modern color pictures. Most of them are monochrome pictures, but still they get the point across. As I said, a very nice astronomy book. It's one of my favorites. And I keep picking it up periodically, and I've got a great big paper marker in two of the pages. One of the pages tells me exactly how much mass and how much distance every one of the planets in the solar system is, and how large and how much distance is each one of the moons going around each one of the planets that were known at that time. The total number of moons in the solar system now is just about doubled in the last few years, but still, Baker gives me a lot of raw information. When it comes to me calculating how much lunar gravity and how much solar gravity I would measure in my backyard, I go to Baker. It tells me how many kilograms, 10 to the 27th power, I think, is the mass of the Earth, and how many kilograms is the mass of the Sun, and how many miles in between.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So I go to my bookmarker on Baker, I immediately get the raw data. I can there, knowing the inverse square law of gravity, I can then calculate how much gravity happens on each one, or what should the period of rotation be, and so on. So awful good information that I need from time to time. For me, it's a real fun book. Now, when it comes to astronomy, ain't nobody better doing astronomy than National Aeronautics and Space Administration. And who's our National Astronomer? Who's our NASA expert is Paul. Did you guys
get a comment first?
Oh, okay. Go ahead, John.
Dick, it's great you mentioned that book. Yes, that is a good book. There's another one called Red Giants and White Dwarfs. It's very good for the person who wants to start out. An interesting thing you mentioned about the money in astronomy. Edwin Hubble, who was an attorney originally, was fighting for years to have the Nobel Prize awarded to astronomers and astrophysicists, which it was never done, and he never got it, but he should have, for his discoveries, and they don't award it posthumously. So he is the reason they now award the Nobel Prize for astronomy, and if it wasn't for his battle, it would have never been done. A lot of people don't know that.
Thank you, John. That's a good one. That one I didn't know. So there are people who worked with Hubble at the time, and they said he was a guy with a phony British accent and a funny air to himself. In other words, he had a snooty attitude, some people thought. But even if I had to work with a guy like that, when he was that smart, doing that kind of good work, even if he's got some funny quirks to his personality, a little bit hard to take, I'd be willing to put up with that. A couple of the people I've worked with from time to time are real tough on the troops, heavy on insults. And every so often I would work with one of those guys, I would respect them because of their braininess, I would put up with their insults, and from time to time I would say, hey Mike, what's the matter, you don't like me anymore? You haven't given me an insult. I've been here for 2 hours today, and you haven't given me an insult yet. You don't like me anymore? I would make a joke out of it. And so there are ways you can live with a person that has a pretty tough to live with personality. But you have to look at the big picture. You have to take the good with the bad. Nobody's perfect. And so there are some people out there that are real tough on the troops, but it's worth making the investment to be near them because they're still up brainy and they're still doing some good work. That's a set of opinions. Okay, Paul, what's Curiosity been doing? It's starting to eat some dirt. And one of these days it's going to find some of those microbes, leading us to believe that Mars at one time did have the rare ingredient for life. Because, by the way, I went to a geology measurement, a geology lecture last Friday night. Let me drop. A geology measurement, a geology lecture that was given at Suffolk Community College, the Selden campus. And if you go to Suffolk Community College and look up these lectures that are free to the public starting at 7 o'clock at night, the price is right. And Stony Brook University with their open nights on geology, astronomy, and whatever. Beautiful. Thanks. Anyhow, when you find out about the fact that as a planet ages and as the core cools off, that the core is no longer molten and therefore rotating, therefore no longer making a magnetic field, that magnetic field around the Earth is giving us a beautiful protective field. That magnetic field creates the Van Allen belt and all of those zillions of pounds of charged particles coming out of the sun called solar wind. They would be bombarding the Earth with these charged particles, creating all kinds of radiation, which is very dangerous to life. And that doesn't happen because those charged particles hit the Van Allen belt, get trapped into it, and they end up coming out at the North Pole and the South Pole, creating the Aurora Borealis. But that's giving you a beautiful life protection. So you need a magnetic field, you need a rotating molten core on a planet in order to have that magnetic field. Apparently the core on Mars has solidified, no longer molten, no longer rotating, therefore Mars no longer has a magnetic field, therefore Mars is not able to hold on to its atmosphere, doesn't have its protective Van Allen belt, and therefore life on Mars today would be very difficult. Another reason why I don't want to send a astronaut there. I don't want him to be subjected to living on a planet which doesn't have that beautiful protective shield of the Van Allen belt caused by the magnetic field. So Mars probably had a molten core at one time, probably had a magnetic field, probably had a Van Allen belt, probably had an atmosphere, probably had the rare ingredients for life. This as many million years downrange from that period on Mars to now measure the evidence of life that existed some number, or the at least the rare ingredients that existed some number of million years ago. That's a difficult measurement. However, with the right kind of instrumentation, you'd be amazed what you can measure. When it comes to, say, for instance, that ice man that they discovered on Mount Everest, they found a frozen man that had been frozen 5,000 years ago. He was frozen on that planet before the pyramids were built. And by properly analyzing the food that was in his stomach and the bones that were broken and the arrow tip that was in his back, and you know that he was hit with an arrow and that's probably what killed him. Why did somebody want to kill him on the side of the mountain at that time? But making the right kind of measurements of his DNA and making the right kind of measurements with an MRI machine and things like this and an X-ray machine, there's a tremendous amount of evidence of what did he eat, where did he go, what kind of instrumentation did he use. He was carrying this very high quality copper axe. Why did the people who killed him not steal the axe even though he stole his arrows that he was carrying and so on? So the evidence you can measure 5,000 years later on the Earth is kind of amazing. Therefore, I know darn well with the right kind of measurements on Curiosity on Mars, even though they're looking for evidence of what happened a million years ago, or a couple of million years ago, I think they're eventually going to find it. So, how are they doing so far, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW in the Big Net.
Hey, Dick. WS2N. Another book I like, The Astronomist, that's the name of it. It's actually it was written at the same time when the PBS show was on. It was all about
the actual astronomers through time and what they discovered. It's been dated now, it's probably 15, 20 years old, I guess, but it really gives you a good layout of all the level behind it. All the discoveries, their life, really puts things in perspective. I like that book. Got the hardcover book, probably cost about $25. You can always go to the library and get it. They don't have to support it for you. Let me drop it. We got the curiosity, you know, you've got the Mars Venus paradox. You know, you don't have the magnetic field on Venus, but then you've got the thick clouds that are probably 90 times the pressure standing on a planet that you have here. And you have a rarefied atmosphere on Mars because the sun blew everything away. So you have to figure out that how come Nick has the answer for Mars. If you have the answer for Venus, I have a guess, but I'm not sure about it. I only have a guess. Do you want to do that before we get to curiosity?
That's your choice, Paul. Put the audio a little bit louder, because there's a little bit of hiss in the background. It sounds good, but I want to make sure there's enough audio there. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, so how's this sound if I go through the other repeat?
Oh, that sounds beautiful. There was about 20% hiss when you were going to the Western machine. Now, if you're going to the Eastern machine, you're essentially dead full quiet and cold. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I was going to leave it this way, but I was talking to John earlier, but then I pushed over because the signal really came up. Probably got some better up here. Okay, we'll stay here. I think Venus has had so many volcanoes. Thousands and thousands of volcanoes that have gone off over the years, creating all this carbon dioxide. And I think in the future, it can come back, you know, millions of years from now, I think the atmosphere will be eventually stripped away from Venus like Mars. That's my guess. So, we'll go with that theory for now. You don't see any really active volcanoes right now on Venus. I think it's on the way to becoming a dead dry planet. Okay, curiosity. I think it was last week or a week before I might have just spoke. I thought they were putting the third samples into the SAM sampler. The SAM is the sampling at Mars. You know, that's a different piece of equipment than the Kenman. They call it the Kenman. That's where you put these samples. I don't think they've used the SAM analyzer yet. I think the SAM analyzer will really detect the, look for carbon. That's what they're really looking for. So I think the Kenman, it just gives you a real exact what measurement of what the material is made of. Let me drop it. Compared to the other detectors, they have one on the arm. They have one on all the different rovers. They're able to figure out pretty much what each rock was made out of. Kenman is like one more level above that. Do a lot better math. What each rock is made of. So we'll see how that does. I think you're up to about 75, 78 stoles in Washington days. So it's been up there a while, like beginning of August. We'll see. I think someday they're gonna make a fuss and they're gonna confirm what they're looking for. Whether they find amino acids and all of that, that remains to be seen.
I hope they do. Because it's been a long journey. I'd like to see some kind of proof that the, you know, life did exist at one time on Mars. That would be great. Let me drop. Not much really for the space net. Paid a lot of attention to the storm coming up. But one thing I wanted to mention was the Dragon successfully landed in the Pacific Ocean, the cargo vessel that went up to the International Space Station for the second time. Undocked after one, 2-3 weeks up there, and in about a couple hours, deorbited, went down to the through the atmosphere with its ablative heat shield, and landed very close to the recovery ship by SpaceX. And now they'll have all their equipment that they wanted to bring back to the IS. And this is the only vehicle the shuttle has been retired that can bring back heavy items from the space station. Experiments that scientists want to get back on Earth. The progress of the spaceship can bring people back and very little hardware to drop. So here we are. We have a private company able to send a spacecraft up and bring one back. And a lot of other companies are waiting in the wings. The next one to go is Orbital Sciences. They'll be launching the Ares rocket, eventually with the Cygnus spacecraft on board on top of that in the future. Right now, they just want to show that they could launch the Ares. For the first stage, kind of same kind of look to the two engines being side-by-side, like the Gemini spacecraft has the Titan rocket that used to launch the Gemini spaceship. So, good luck to them, and then, you know, if they could launch this, and then eventually, I think, beginning of next year, at the end of this year, they're going to put a Cygnus spacecraft on top, make sure that thing works okay. And by the springtime, they'll be stocking with the space station. The only difference is that Orbital Science with the Cygnus spacecraft is similar to the Progress ship. It's going to bring up supplies, but it's going to burn up over the Pacific Ocean. SpaceX, one up on them, because not only can they bring these spacecraft back, they're reusable. They'll be able to take the same one, put it on top of another Falcon 9 rocket, blast it off out of space. You know, it's pretty good. That's pretty much all I had. I do have one topic totally unrelated to this. So I'll bring that up whenever you get a chance. Back to you, Dick.
Hi, thank you, Paul. You did mention Venus a little bit there earlier. Our nuclear-class submarines, I don't know the exact depth they can go to, but it's something in the vicinity of 3,000 feet. And if you go much below that, you're probably below the crush depth. 3,000 feet gives you an amount of water pressure on the submarine that's approximately 88 atmospheres, 88 times the 14.7 pounds per square inch that we have at the surface of the Earth. So 88 atmospheres will crush, approximately 88 atmospheres will crush a nuclear class submarine made by the United States. To my knowledge, Venus has an atmospheric pressure at the surface that is not 88 atmospheres, it's approximately 150 atmospheres. It's almost 2-to-1 beyond the crusher of a nuclear submarine. There are fancy very specifically made submarines to go down to the trench at the middle of the Pacific Ocean. But your ordinary submarine could not survive the surface pressure of Venus. It's amazing to me. So you get some huge variations in the conditions that you would be experiencing. I mean, there's lots of science fiction of astronauts going to Venus, and Venus is going to be this nice tropical forest type place. Not a chance. That pressure, that acid in the atmosphere, that's going to eat up almost anything you've got. It's a really tough place. And Mars, with all of its radiation from the sun, no protection, no atmosphere, cold as all hell, dry as all hell. Why in the world would you want to send an astronaut there to that particular... It's worse than the most barren desert you can find.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
The conditions on Mars are worse than the most barren desert you can find on Earth. As far as dryness, tremendously colder, no atmosphere, and no atmospheric protection. No matter how you get an astronaut there, the chances of you getting him there safely and getting him back home are near zero. And even if you could get him back home, with all of those years of exposure to all of that radiation, his chances of getting cancer and a whole lot of other nasty conditions are extremely high. So it's the right place to send a automated machine. And by the same token, when it comes to conducting warfare, to do it with drones, to do it with machines, is a heck of a lot nicer way to carry on a war as opposed to spilling the blood of American soldiers. Yeah, it's got a nasty characteristic to it. But still, if you're running a war, and if you've got to run a war, it's a much better way of doing it from my point of view. So good instrumentation, whether it comes to the James Webb or the Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory, whether it comes to the Galileo and the spacecraft that are going around Jupiter and Saturn, these automatic spacecraft, boy, can they do great things. That Voyager spacecraft, let me think. I think Voyager was launched somewhere around 1976, 30-some-odd years ago, and it's three times the distance of Pluto, moving away from us at something like 8,000 miles an hour. And it is still talking back to us with its, what used to be a 10-watt transmitter is down to 6 watts. Something like 80, I think it's 80 billion kilometers away. Really long distance. And there are people who never would believe you could send a radio beam that far. Three times the distance to Pluto, where the round trip time for the radio signal at the speed of light 33 hours to send a radio signal that far is mind-blowing. And it's the strongest piece of evidence I've got of a philosophy, and that is you and I with our ham radio equipment or your broadcast transmitter or whatever, or your Bluetooth transmitter or your 802.11 transmitter, any other transmitter you've got, you issue a radio signal, it will bounce all over the place. And it will get to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. It goes everywhere. You can't stop it from doing that. You issue a radio wave, it will go everywhere. The only thing left to discuss, as you've heard me say before, is how strong is it when it gets there? Is it above the threshold of the instruments you're using at this time to receive that signal at that location? No matter how weak the signal is, as long as you're willing to transmit the signal in the right protocol, the right format, as long as you're willing to build a receiver that's more narrowband than required, with the right kind of integration factor, you will force that signal to be above threshold. The classic example of that right now is that...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Until the last few years, anybody who wants to do the real portion of ham radio that separates the men from the boys, moon bounce. On 432, for instance, you send the signal toward the moon. It goes 250,000 miles. A little bit of your signal your signal might be out of an antenna that is 10 degrees wide, and the moon is only half a degree wide. So only a few percent of your signal hits the moon. The rest of it passes by to the left, to the right, and above and below, and it misses the moon. So a little bit of the signal you send with your kilowatt transmitter, great big antenna, a little bit of it hits the moon. Of the amount that hits the moon, 7% of it is reflected. Of the 7% that's reflected, it transmits back, it reflects back the 250,000 miles and comes back to your little antenna on the Earth, and you capture an extremely small percentage of it. You put that all together, that moon-bound signal, from the time you transmit until you get a signal back, the signal that comes back is 263 decibels weaker. That's a huge number on a logarithmic scale. How much weaker is the signal that comes back compared to the one that you transmitted? You write down 26 zeros after the 1. That is the ratio. 263 dB. It's more than 26 zeros after the 1 is the ratio of what you sent versus what you get back. Under those conditions, to do moonbound in the normal manner requires a clean 1,000 watts of signal getting to the antenna, an antenna of approximately 400 square feet of radio area. It's about as big as you can normally put into your backyard. Let me drop. So that's the transmitting antenna. You're putting 1,000 watts of power or more into it. The echo that comes back, you flip the receiving antenna back into the receiving mode. You have a 1 decibel or a fraction of a decibel noise figure preamplifier, 120 decibels of gain in the receiver, and then you put a set of earphones on that receiver and you're listening for that extremely weak signal in the noise. That separates the men from the boys. To get that all together, proper aiming, big antenna, low noise preamplifier, real steady transmitter signal, a real steady receiver, narrow band receiver, and human integration between your ears, and your ears have a 70 cycle noise equivalent bandwidth when you're doing real weak signal with proper training in that sort of thing. So for a human being to sit in front of a ham radio rig and do moon bounce, up until a few years ago, that's what it takes. And along comes Mr. Joe Taylor, K1JT, who invented the weak signal Joe Taylor, WSJT techniques, which is a fancier method of transmitting 4 individual tones in certain combinations with computer processing of a manner similar to what used to be called radio teletype. So it's a more elaborate radio teletype-like receiver. Instead of marking space, it's the combination of 4 tones. You put that all together. That receiving system is so much better at digging that signal out of the noise, called the right protocol, that now you've got approximately a 10 or 15 decibel advantage. Instead of requiring 16 state-of-the-art Yagis, properly aimed on this 400 square foot antenna to do moon bounce on 432, 1 or 2 single Yagis mounted on the chimney of the house when the moon's in the right position with
repeater, timeout, cancel.
So 1 or 2 Yagis on the roof of the house with 150 watts, not a kilowatt, into it with that WSJT technique is capable of doing moon bounce. Now, there are guys who say, hey, this ain't fair, because the usual definition of a real valid ham radio contact is that a human being does all the receiving. He sits in front of the rig in one particular sitting session. He transmits signals. He transmits an unknown piece of information, like signal strength and his call letters. And the guy on the other end receives the full set of call letters, receives the signal strength report, and gets a set of Rogers both directions. That information was passed in both directions. That's the usual definition of a valid contact. And now you get this computer that writes the message across the screen, because it's listened to the super weak signal. And there are times when it can listen to a signal 28 decibels below the noise and get valid copy. Is that an unfair advantage? Yes, it is. Does it fulfill the original definition of a valid contact? No, it does not. So I think the fair way to do it is to keep two separate lists. One list of a guy who does moon bounce by the conventional human operator technique, and another technique, and another list where the guys do moon bounce and they talk to guys in 50 different countries by way of a computer process. It is an advancement in the state of the art. You don't want to throw it away just because it doesn't fit your definition. But it's a beautiful bit of advancement of the art. It is those kind of techniques of these more valid weak signal protocols that allows you to send that signal from the Voyager spacecraft across 80 billion kilometers of space, and you now listen to how many impacts it's...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That Voyager spacecraft is the most far-reaching piece of hardware ever issued by mankind. It's sitting out there making measurements of how much solar radiation, how much your cosmic rays, how much your galactic radiation. It's sending back this data that's telling you what it sees. The question we keep asking Voyager is, hey, what do you see? It's a little bit like what I've often said, this is an exaggeration, but what I've often said, when you finally talk to somebody in a foreign country with your ham radio equipment, yeah, you can do it as a competition. Hello, goodbye, send me your QSL card, we've made a contact, and I now can chalk up your country. Yeah, that's one way of doing it. But once you've established this radio contact, you've got something in common with that guy, you both got a ham license, you're both interested in wireless technology and electronics. Once you've got that guy on the other end of a microphone or the other end of a Morse code key, you can ask him, what is life like in your country? What do you like? What do you dislike? What's your favorite hobby? When you open your front door on Monday morning and you're about to go to work, you open your front door and you look out there, what do you see? There's all kinds of questions like that where real human interface takes place. And all of a sudden, what you think is prejudice melts away. You think that that guy is a different religion, a different country, a different vocabulary, a different language, a different lifestyle, different clothing, different everything, different food. And all of a sudden, you've got something in common. And when it comes to ham radio operators really creating communication among human beings, all you've got to do is listen to that really beautiful interview that was done with Steve Mendelson, WA2DHF, Do Have Fun, which became MV or MS, something like that. Anyhow, if you are a member of LIMARC and you've gotten that message, then you can also go to ARL. By way of ARL, you can find the interview that was done about 6 months or a year ago when Steve Mendelson knew that he was about to die of pancreatic cancer. And they really did an interview of what his life was like. And you hear his description of how he got involved with the New York City Marathon for 30-some-odd years and the Los Angeles Marathon. And you listen to his interface with four different presidents, with Walter Cronkite. He talked Walter Cronkite in getting his ham radio license. He was the guy who did the Morse code interview of Walter Cronkite. And when they had the very first contact, when Walter Cronkite was so happy that he got his ham radio license, and he made his first contact with Steve Mendelson on 10 meters. And during that contact, a man somewhere in Iowa, somewhere out there, listened to that contact and said, that is the worst imitation of Walter Cronkite I've ever heard. A man said that during the QSO between Steve Mendelson and Walter Cronkite. And the two of them had so much humbleness, at least Walter did, that they didn't tell him. A couple of years later, Steve Mendelson met that man at the Dayton Hamvention, who walked up to him and said, "This Steve Mendelson out here, yeah? You mean to tell me that contact I had really was, that I was listening to, really was Walter Cronkite?" He said, "It sure was." That's just one of about 10 of these interesting human interest stories. You listen to that interview of Steve. Very well done, very well edited. It goes on for about an hour. The first 10 minutes of it are a little bit boring, but once it gets rolling, it's really worth listening to. The bottom line of all this is that...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
speak too while.
The bottom line of this is he was part of the philosophy that really allows human intervention, communication among ham radio operators. Bernie, what's the easiest way that a person can find that interview? Very well done. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 LIW in the Tech Net.
Well, funny you mention that, because I just put a link to it in the Dropbox for the October 28th notes from the TechNet. If you want to join that Dropbox, just send me an email at bernie@huntfamily.com. Go to QRZ, look up K2YO. Drop me an email, I'll send you an invitation to join the Dropbox. The other solution is just Google Steve Mendelson interview, and it'll be the first hit that you get.
Very good suggestion, Bernie. I'm a little bit worried that there probably are a couple of other interviews with Steve, but that one that was done, I think, in California, when he was a few months away from passing away, extremely well done. The right questions were asked. The right kind of editing took place. And it really shows you the value of ham radio in a way that it's hard to duplicate. Steve will admit that he was a polarizing person. He had a fairly strong personality, and there were a few people who were annoyed with Steve's personality. And now, in the big picture, we find out that that was invalid, so to speak. Just like I told you guys earlier, every so often I worked with some smart people who are tough on the troops, a little bit insulting, not complimenting people all the time, if you know what I mean, doing the opposite. But if you can get past the insult, it was worth being near the person. I mean, the effect is accumulative of being near him, and education and information gets passed. And so Steve is an interesting person. There was a lot more to him than first met the eye, and after that interview, I was a little bit unhappy about the fact that I didn't get closer to him during the last few years and listen to some of those stories. The fact that those particular stories, there's about 10 of them that are in that interview, guarantee there must be at least 10 more that he's got to talk about as to what happened to him when he's on Air Force One, what happens when he's meeting presidents and other people during his broadcast experience where he's setting up microphones and cameras, what it was like to interface with Walter Cronkite, and a whole lot of things like that. Very well done. All right, and if we have any further questions or comments on any of these subjects up for now, give me a call that is right now, K2LIW in the Tech Net.
Excellent. Did I make it through to the end, Dick?
Yes, you sure did. Lisa, when you passed it back to me, that's when I picked up, and I didn't make very much comment on the things that you said, so therefore, I guess I led you to believe that you dropped out. I don't think you did, Paul. I think we heard you very nicely up to the end. If I was real smart, I could remember now exactly what your last comment was. And I think it was on the subject of curiosity. WS2M, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. I went for the topics of the Dragon spacecraft and all. And the new company, Orbital Spines, is going to launch at Antares. But my last comment was I just wanted to comment. Nothing to do with the space program, but some weather gadget I have here. I just wanted to talk about the transmitter on it. I'm kind of fascinated with it.
Now, I did want to mention the fact that now that the Dragon is able to come back down and land without burning up in the ocean, and is capable of bringing 1,000 or 2,000 pounds of material back, and the material being brought back are instruments that are going to be refurbished and biological samples of the astronauts, which are being brought back down to the Earth in order to be analyzed. So to have the ability to bring things back down, many thousands of pounds of things, is very valuable. The Soyuz can take back human beings, but can't take back any substantial amount of hardware. Can't take back very many pounds. It has no trouble bringing down the astronauts and their oxygen supply. So, it looks like we're coming out not quite yet with the capability we had with the shuttle as far as how many pounds it could bring back down. It could, you know, capture a satellite and bring it back down. But at a significant risk, as we now know. Okay. I'm going to make a guess, Paul, that what you're describing is that Radio Shack had a thing like this. In other words, you put at the top of your tower this weather measuring thing, and by way of a 802.11 or Zigbee or whatever communication or Bluetooth, by way of some kind of intercommunication, the device talks to your other display device in the house, telling you wind speed, air pressure, wind velocity. It reminds me a little bit of the article I just saw in This Old House that's on PBS this week, of where somebody had done a great big job, but a whole lot of renovation of his house, and now all the walls are very nicely finished off, and he suddenly realized that the thermostat for the third zone of the house is in the wrong place. In order to rewire that thermostat, we'd have to dig up the walls, do all kinds of damage. And so This Old House people showed them that there is a wireless thermostat you can now buy, that once you properly bundle it, there's a whole process on 802.11-like hardware for the radio control model airplanes these days, which they get bundled. In other words, you tell the transmitter, link itself to that receiver, and it scans and finds an empty frequency, and the two of them agree on each other, and they get bundled. And now you locate this wireless thermostat anywhere you want in the house, and the receiving equipment down in the basement alongside your furnace picks up that thermostat signal and controls the valve on the third zone. Beautiful solution. So I'm wondering if your remote weather station is doing something like that, Sir Paul. How many dollars? Where did you buy it? Are you happy with it? WS2N, K2LIW in the Fed Nest.
It turns out these things are quite common now. I do wish I... That'd be nice. I got to go for an anemometer. But another thing is just a basic LCD readout. You know, you can read the inside temperature, the inside relative humidity, and it's got the time and the date. And it's an atomic clock. It gets the signal from Fort Collins, Colorado. And, you know, I had something similar to this. It used to be made by, that was made by Oregon. This one's made by La Crosse. And the one made by Oregon quit, you know. Like a long story short, I wound up fixing that. It was a little bad wire on the power supply, so going to the board. It only had like a hair attached to it. Eventually I been separated, so I just resoldered that back on. But this test, I did that after buying this thing, buying the other one, so now I have two. Let me drop it. The difference is the new one has the outdoor thermostat. And again, quite common. I mean, this unit was about $38, and actually came out of coal. I did have to send away for it then. It wasn't in the store, but you can get them probably in quite a few different places. I thought it was unusual that Coles had it, but they had it in Kentucky. Got the channel logo on it, so I think it's set back and it's probably pretty good. And so far, it is good. It gives you the high temperatures indoors, the low temperatures. So again, fascinating with the transmitter. It transmits on 33 centimeters. It's, you know, 915, which is 915 megahertz, which is in the hand, it's actually in the hand band. We saw it up at what, 902. Now I thought I took this thing up and I would have nothing but interference with my equipment. Let me drop it. And that's why I'm kind of amazed by it. I got this thing sitting here, sitting on top of my Kenwood 440. That blow mic 440 is the 2 meter brick that I put out, 55 watts, talking to you on. And I could transmit on 2 meters. All, you know, a lot of the different bands on transmit on all the bands on the HF brick. I've tried 40 and 80 and 10. And there's no interference. I mean, I thought maybe this thing would go haywire even with the local oscillator or something. Nothing. I mean, it's rock solid. So that kind of amazes me that
that there's no interference. I don't have 440 capability. I can't transmit on 70 centimeters. I'd like to give that a try and see if that thing interferes a bit. But I guess that, I mean, it's really solid. The other thing that amazes me is two little batteries out there. I'm dropping on the transmitter, and you can put it up to 300 feet away. And they're claiming with these two AA batteries that this thing, that you'll probably have to change the batteries maybe once every 2 years. Now I'm reading the book, and I'm also looking at the LCD display. Yeah. 4 seconds, and it does. I mean, that thing is sitting out there transmitting away digitally, I'm sure, of course, but every 4 seconds, and this thing's going to last 2 years on two AA batteries. That blows me away. I've got a couple hundred feet away, to a piece of wood, you know, on a 6 foot stockade fence. Had to put a cover over it. You got to keep it out of the sun. But amazing that I thought I'd just let you know about this thing. Back to you, WS.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Two AA batteries for that length of time. Wow. How many measurements does it make, Paul? Does it measure temperature, wind speed, and wind direction? How many measurements does it make? What brand name? How many dollars? You probably told me that, but repeat that. How many measurements? What brand name and how many dollars? Where'd you buy it? WS2N, K2LIW.
And it come out of Kohl's. They sell clothes and stuff, but they sell kids stuff. I've seen different kinds of watches in there. Well, they also sell these things. This one wasn't in stock. This company, it's called LaCrosse. LA and then it's space cross BRSSE technology. And if you look at stuff on the internet, they must have 30 different types of these types of things. You know, some of them color displays and all, and they're more expensive. But the other thing I didn't like about the color ones, it looked like you had to plug it in, and this is all battery operated, so I lose power. No problem. Let's look at the readings.
How many different things are? Let's see. We got the time, the date. We've got indoor temperature, indoor relative humidity, outdoor temperature. And when I give you outdoor temperature, it's like 54.8 right now. You know, they go to the decimal point.
It does have a barometer inside, but unfortunately, they don't keep your readout. My other clock does that. But they have, give you an interpretation. What they have is an icon in front. They have a boy standing there with, in this case, he's got the umbrella on the dropper. And there's two clouds above it with rain, you know. And that changes, you know, depending on what the weather is going to be in the next 12 hours or so. And that's based on all the different pieces of information, including the barometer. And then they do have an arrow. They let you know that the pressure right now is dropping. Well, you know that because the storm is coming. So that's pretty much it. They also give you, by pushing a button, a high temperature, what the last high temperature was, and what the last low temperature, either outdoor or indoor, was, which I kind of like. You know, nice that in the wintertime, when we get there, I'd like to know, you know, what was the lowest temperature during the night. Pretty good. That's pretty much it. It's also an alarm clock, but I'm not going to use it for that. But also what I'd like, let me drop it.
Tell us, how long are you going to bought that at Kohl's? Do you think it's still being sold? Back to you, Paul.
Is the atomic clock. My other one was an atomic clock also, which WW being Fort Collins, Colorado, which I brushed up on, and I'd forgotten about this, but their transmissions, when they send their code, you know, for date, time, and all, you know, instead of sending a tone and then a blank space, the tone and a blank space, I mean, they send that, but the information is coming across on the blank space, not on the tone. You know, it's like if you hear a tone beep and then a space, it's not the beep that's either giving you a zero or a one. It's the amount of time that the space has occurred that gives you either a zero or a one. It's amazing to read about that. Back to you, Dick. WS2M.
That sounds awful nice. How long ago did you buy that at Kohl's, and do you think Kohl's is still selling it at home?
Yeah, it walked in, I saw it on the website, and you could send away for it. But rather than do that, I went down and I thought, well, maybe they have something in there or something similar to it, and they didn't. So they have the big computer there, and you get somebody to dial it in for you. If you know how to do it, you can do it yourself, I guess. But inside of a couple of days, it shows up from... from UPS, and that's it, and that was about two weeks ago, still running, so, couldn't quit yet.
Sounds good. When it comes to light-emitting diodes and flashlights, I've owned quite a few of them, and most of them that are bright enough have got about 3, 4, 5, 10 individual light-emitting bulbs at the front end of the thing, and they got a lot of light, and the batteries last nice and long, but it's a kind of a floodlight, so it's just the light smeared all over the place. I found one that really is a nice, sharp beam of a light with one single super bright light-emitting diode in the middle of a parabolic lens. And when I saw the ad for this thing, I decided to buy two of them, one for me and for my son, and now that whenever he and I do any automobile repair at nighttime outside, we use this flashlight. This flashlight is 7 inches long. The front end of it is 2 inches in diameter, the rest of it's about 1.5 inches. Runs on 3 penlight cells, AA cells, and it goes for some number of hundreds of hours, I don't know. A very bright light. It's made by Magnolite, magnolite.com, and it's called the Bright Star Razor is the name of the thing. Bright Star Razor. It's also called the WorkSafe Intrinsic Series. So they make a very nice flashlight by my standards. Rugged as all hell. Looks like you could drop it from at least 20 feet without damaging it. The back end of it has got a beautiful great big seal on it, so the thing is good underwater. And the only thing that it's lacking is it doesn't have a magnet on the back end which will stick to the hood of the car and hold itself in position. But other than that, these light-emitting diodes are coming a long way. They're going to dominate our... Let me drop this. They're going to dominate our television sets, our display screens, our laptop computers, the lighting in our house. They're going to dominate a lot of things. And that's a solid-state laser. Lasers are going to catch on. One quick question there. Has anybody who went to the flea market today want to give us a quick description of what they saw, what they liked, and whatever? Anybody want to give us a flea market description? Give me your call letters right now. KQLAW in the tech net. Okay, because of the weather condition, I was worrying that the attendance would be a little bit late. When I talked to Andy, the V2CDL, he told me that they had a pretty good attendance. A fair number of vendors, a fair number of buyers, so it worked rather well. We'll eventually get somebody to tell us what it was like. Alrighty, now we've done all of our obligations. That is to say, we've answered everybody's question who signed in the beginning. We did our mailbag, and we did our space report. Now we're willing to go over... Now it's time to go over to the deeper subjects. And, Wes, you did send us last week quite a number of YouTube videos. One of them is at least an hour long about the AB concept. I forget what the AB, two different names. And I know that when John saw it and when I saw it, we got very little out of it. A very erudite guy. Looks like he's a guy with a lot of credentials, gave the speech. He paced back and forth in front of this room, giving the speech about the AB concept. And I think he was talking about the atomic level world, I think he was, but from my point of view, it was kind of hard to listen to this hour lecture and walk out of that text, walk out of that classroom whistling that tune, if you know what I mean. For people who are deep into the theory of atomic level physics, possibly that's valuable information. But me, as a guy who thinks in the macroscopic world, and occasionally goes down to the microscopic world, the atomic level world, I'm having trouble figuring out what he was trying to say and how I can use it. So I was missing